Our third reading is Luke chapter 1, verses 57 to 80. You may find it a help just to turn to it in these green booklets. It's on page 6. The birth of John the Baptist. Now the time came for Elizabeth to give birth, and she bore a son. And her neighbours and relatives heard that the Lord had shown great mercy to her, and they rejoiced with her. And on the eighth day they came to circumcise the child. And they would have called him Zechariah after his father, but his mother answered, "No, he shall be called John." And they said to her, "None of your relatives is called by this name." And they made signs to his father, inquiring what he wanted him to be called. And he asked for a writing tablet and wrote, "His name is John." And they all wondered. And immediately his mouth was opened and his tongue loosed, and he spoke, blessing God. And fear came on all their neighbours. And all these things were talked about through all the hill country of Judea, and all who heard them laid them up in their hearts, saying, "What then will this child be?" For the hand of the Lord was with him. And his father Zechariah was filled with the Holy Spirit and prophesied, saying, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for he has visited and redeemed his people, and has raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David, as he spoke by the mouth of his holy prophets from of old, that we should be saved from our enemies and from the hand of all who hate us, to show the mercy promised to our fathers and to remember his holy covenant, the oath that he swore to our father Abraham, to grant us that we, being delivered from the hand of our enemies, might serve him without fear in holiness and righteousness before him all our days. And you, child, will be called the prophet of the Most High, for you will go before the Lord to prepare his ways, to give knowledge of salvation to his people in the forgiveness of their sins, because of the tender mercy of our God, whereby the sunrise shall visit us from on high, to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace." And the child grew and became strong in spirit, and he was in the wilderness until the day of his public appearance to Israel. Cakes and crackers, Santa and stockings, turkey and tinsel, mistletoe and mince pies, presents and puddings, Christmas, aren't we forgetting something? So ran a radio advertisement which was banned by the broadcasting regulator in Ireland earlier this month. You can advertise alcohol, but not what Christmas is all about. But today I'm going to throw caution to the wind, and I'm going to tell you the true meaning of Christmas. It's controversial, could get me in a heap of trouble, but here goes. Here is what the censor didn't want you to hear. To get at the true meaning of Christmas, we need to actually turn back the clock to a time before Santa and stockings, to the first century AD, and the months leading up to the very first Christmas. That was the setting for the Bible reading we just had, and you would find it a help to turn back to that on page 6. The passage was about the birth of someone called John. There were some strange goings on which indicated that this was a little bit special. Chapter 1 verse 7 tells us that the parents, the new parents, were OAPs who were well past childbearing. They were into Zimmers, not nappies. During the pregnancy, the father had been struck dumb, unable to say a word. Then 8 days after the birth, at the naming ceremony, he gets his speech back. And in this remarkable prophecy, he explains the significance of the birth. The news about these strange goings on, it spreads like a forest fire. Verse 65, all these things were talked about throughout all the hill country of Judea. And it's in the words of this old man, in verses 68 to 79, that we discover the true meaning of Christmas. What is Christmas all about? Well, firstly, in Jesus, God has paid us a visit. In Jesus, God has paid us a visit. In the Old Testament, God had promised that one day he would step into human history in the person of a ruler, the one who would be called the Christ or the Messiah. But just before he came, God would send a final prophet who would announce his coming and prepare the way for him. Well, plenty of dads have high hopes, don't they, for their newborn babies? But just look at what this dad says in verse 76 about his baby. And you, child, will be called the prophet of the Most High, for you will go before the Lord to prepare his ways. In the birth of this child, John, the prophet had come. The curtain was about to go up on this unique phase of human history. The birth of John signalled that God himself was about to step onto the stage of our world in the person of the Christ, the Messiah. God was paying us a visit. And that is the language used in verse 68. It says, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for he has visited and redeemed his people." God had visited his people. How? In what way? Well, verse 69 goes on. He has raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David. A poetic way of referring to the Christ having come. Likewise, verse 78 at the bottom there talks about the tender mercy of our God over the page, whereby the sunrise shall visit us from on high. And the sunrise is another poetic way of referring to the Christ, the ruler from heaven. In Jesus, God has paid us a visit. That is the staggering truth at the heart of Christmas. And it's what the Christmas carols proclaim. Lo, within a manger lies he who built the starry skies. People get very excited, don't they, when a celebrity comes to town. Apparently pandemonium broke out last week at the ice rink in Canada Square because some Dancing on Ice star turned up. But that first Christmas, God himself pitched up. Isn't that something? I mean, people say things like, "I don't believe in God, you know, I've never seen him." Well, you could have. If you'd been living in the first century instead of the 21st century, veiled in flesh, the Godhead see. Hail the incarnate deity. Tomorrow sees the premiere, doesn't it, of The Day the Earth Stood Still, starring Keanu Reeves. It's a remake of that 1951 classic sci-fi film. It's about an alien visitor and his giant robot who visit planet Earth. And I'm sure it's entertaining, but in the end it is just a story. It's just fiction. But this first century account by Luke, who was a doctor, is not just a good story. It is good history. In the first few verses of his account, he relates how he researched everything carefully and he based what he wrote on eyewitness accounts. But the visitor of which he writes was not just an alien. It was God himself. In Jesus, God has paid us a visit. Which begs the question, why? Why would God bother to pay us a visit? I mean, sometimes celebrities, they come to the wharf, don't they, to sign copies of their latest books in Waterstones. Did God come to sign copies of his bestseller, the Bible? Well, this brings us to our second point, which is in Jesus, God has come to rescue us. In Jesus, God has come to rescue us. Zechariah's explanation here of the first Christmas events, it's saturated with the language of rescue. Verse 68, God has visited and redeemed his people. Redeemed means rescue. Verse 69, he has raised up a horn of salvation. Save, rescue, same thing. Verse 71, that we should be saved from our enemies. Verse 74, that we being delivered from the hand of our enemies. Verse 77, to give knowledge of salvation to his people. In Jesus, God came on a rescue mission. So he didn't come in the first place to teach or to heal or to life coach, but to rescue. A rescue accomplished through his death on a cross. Christmas and Easter, they go together. Jesus was born to die because it is through his death that he rescues us. But rescues us from what? Well, twice Zechariah mentions enemies, doesn't he? So verse 71, that we should be saved from our enemies. Verse 74, that we being delivered from the hand of our enemies. The language is taken from the Old Testament. God's people in the Old Testament, they were oppressed by other nations, the Assyrians, the Babylonians. God's people in the first century, they were under Roman occupation. Now, promise of deliverance makes sense in that sort of context, and many of God's people in the world today are living under political oppression. But what does it mean for us? What does it mean for us? Even back then, the promised rescue was not just political, or even primarily political, it was spiritual. Just look at how verse 79 describes the human condition. In Jesus, God came to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death. The human condition is one of darkness. We are sitting in the dark, morally, spiritually speaking. You see, to be out of relationship with God is to be in the dark, spiritually. And this darkness is all the deeper because verse 79 says that we live our lives in the shadow of death. From the very moment we're born, death casts its dark shadow over the lives of each of us. There's no avoiding death, is there? It's the ultimate statistic. One in every one person dies. But people try to cope with death in different ways, don't they? So some, like Woody Allen, they make light of death. His comment, "I'm not afraid of death, I just don't want to be there when it happens." Others, like Lord Archer, they just ignore it. In a recent interview, Lord Archer, who's now 68, he was asked if he dwelt much on his mortality. "Certainly not," he replied. "I just get on with life." Others, like Bertrand Russell, they look death squarely in the face and they assert that there is nothing to fear. "When I die, I rot." But the Bible assures us that death is not the end. And the reason we should be concerned about that is the little word at the end of verse 77. Sins. Sins are all the different ways in our lives in which we fail to love God and love one another. And the root sin is a refusal to live with God as God in our lives. And after death, we'll be called to account for that by God, for how we've lived. The Bible warns us of the prospect of darkness, not just in this life, but eternally, being separated from God forever. This is what God in Jesus has come to rescue us from. He has come to give light to those who sit in darkness. He's the rising sun. He's the dawn of a new day. In the words of verse 77, he brings salvation to his people in the forgiveness of their sins because of the tender mercy of God. Once you are forgiven by God, death has lost its sting. Don't know about you, I don't remember much from my driving lessons, which were many years ago now. But one thing that did stick with me was the mantra for dealing with junctions where you've got those crisscross yellow lines. Don't enter the box until your exit is clear. Well, that's pretty good advice for dealing with death as well, actually. One day we all end up in a box. Don't enter the box until your exit is clear. Well, in Jesus, God gives us a clear exit into his presence forever. But what about life now? I mean, what difference does this rescue make in the here and now? Wouldn't I just be signing up for a life of religion and rituals and services and meetings in an already full diary? The goal of rescue is not religion. It is relationship with God. Verse 79. In Jesus, God has come to guide our feet into the way of peace. This search for peace within, in our hearts, it's something of a universal obsession, isn't it? But where do you get it? Somebody said, "My therapist told me that the way to achieve true inner peace is to finish what I start. So far today, I've finished 2 bags of M&Ms and a chocolate cake, and I feel better already." But the Bible's saying that peace within actually comes from peace with God. This is what he offers us in Jesus. The goal of rescue is peace with God, but it's also the service of God. Verse 74 says that we might serve him without fear in holiness and righteousness before him all our days. It's a common misconception that serving God is just about becoming a vicar, but serving God is about living your life for God, being the person that God created you to be. To do so is to invest your life in eternity, To fail to do so is to waste your life. Somebody wrote this. They said, what women want, to be loved, to be listened to be desired, to be respected, to be needed, to be trusted, and sometimes just to be held. What men want, tickets for the Six Nations. Well, gender stereotyping aside, surely one thing all of us want, men and women, is we want our lives to count for something. We don't just want to do time on the planet, working, eating, sleeping, watching Coronation Street. Instinctively we feel, don't we, that there must be more to life than this. And the Bible's saying there is. It's living for God and serving Him and His purposes. But how do we know all this is true? In Jesus, did God really pay us a visit? In Jesus, did God really come to rescue us? You see, these are big claims. And the bigger the claims, the bigger our natural skepticism. You see, if I tell you that Asda are giving away free tins of baked beans, you'd probably not be too skeptical. But if I told you that they were giving away a free trip to Disneyland with every tin of baked beans, yeah, there'd be lots of eyebrows flying off the tops of lots of heads. Well, the Christmas claims are at least as big as a free trip to Disneyland. And so skepticism is understandable. Zechariah himself, he was very skeptical when he was first told. Why trust the Christmas claims? Well, certainly one reason is because in Jesus, God has kept His word. And I just want to leave you with this third point as we close. In Jesus, God has kept His word. You see, these Jesus events fulfilled what God had promised in the Old Testament scriptures hundreds of years before Jesus came. The coming of Jesus was in verse 70. It was as God spoke by the mouth of His holy prophets from of old. It was in verse 73 to remember the oath that God swore to our father Abraham. Jesus didn't just appear like a bolt from a blue sky. He fulfilled all the promises that God had made through the prophets about the coming of the rescuer king. God had revealed where he would be born, the very village he would be born in. He'd revealed how he would die, the precise means of his execution, and so on. In Jesus, God has kept his word. He always does. Human promises, they're often made with your fingers crossed behind your back. God's promises are something you can build your life on. Last week on the Tube, I saw an advert for London bars and clubs, which ran, "Eat, drink, dance, all your Christmas wishes under one roof." Well, how about that? I mean, I'd be surprised if those three options really did cover all your Christmas wishes this year. I'd be surprised if you didn't have one or two bigger wishes in there. Perhaps wishing you still have a job come January. Perhaps wishing you find a job come January. In this climate of uncertainty, it'd be understandable if you found yourself wishing for a little bit of certainty in life. Luke tells us in chapter 1 verse 4 that the whole reason he's writing his account is that you may have certainty. Certainty about the true meaning of Christmas and certainty about the true meaning of life. Could I just ask you, at the very least, why not read through Luke's gospel account for yourself over this Christmas time? Plenty of people are sceptical. Very few people have ever bothered to read one of the gospel accounts for themselves as an adult. Why not do that this Christmas time? In the new year, we're running here on the Barge a lunchtime Christianity Explored course. It's a great forum for finding out more, for discussing, for asking any questions. Why not come along to the first session of that? Or even, why not do what Zechariah did himself and thank God for Jesus and thank God for his rescue this Christmas time? There's a prayer inside a booklet we'll give you in a goodie bag on the way out that you could pray to do just that this Christmas.